תגור שרוק אינונה ברשותת אדור קושו ניגים יחדית אינונה ישבית קימנה פת ביאר פוצי גרים נקענק נניה פוצי אינויים נייבים מי
And welcome to Ocean Research Project. I'm Matt Rutherford, and I am currently sitting in some mossy lichen peat stuff on an uninhabited island in Greenland. It's about midnight, I would guess. It's hard to tell because the sun never sets in the Arctic this time of year. Absolutely full of ice. I got ice all around me. You might be able to actually hear some of the noise of the ice and the water out in the distance. The ice here always makes a crackling noise, you know, crackling and popping. There's all sorts of air bubbles trapped in it. It makes for a really good glass of whiskey, or at least a very interesting glass of whiskey, as your glass is popping and crackling like crazy the entire time, releasing air that has been trapped in the ice for millennia. So yeah, hey, nothing like millennial-old rocks and scotch, you know? But it's been long. It's been tiring. And, well, we got up to Godhaven, and we were on anchor. And we went there, as I mentioned in the last episode, for Greenland Day. We were hoping there was going to be this big party on the beach. It didn't end up being any party on the beach. Everything was closed. They did sort of traditional Greenlandic dancing. It was really more like polka music and polka dancing. I don't really know if there is such a thing as really traditional Greenlandic dancing in the sense, in the ancient culture at least. I imagine there was some form of music, but nothing like we think of today. So we left out of Godhaven, and we had some winds. Well, before that, when we left out of Sisimiut, the first watch, there were no ice. Nobody spotted any icebergs. And there was sort of this bet, this gamble on whose watch is going to see the first iceberg. I'm on watch with Alexander, who's the cameraman, and Nicole is on watch with Dana, who's the third mate. So their watch came and went, nothing. Our watch, we saw about 7 icebergs. And, you know, they came back on watch, and we bragged about it a little bit. Then, when I got back up, I mean, it must have been 50 icebergs around, you know. I mean, they were just everywhere. And by the time we had to pull into Godhaven, we were passing monster icebergs, just big, massive, hundreds of feet tall, and, you know, who knows how deep they are. Just massive icebergs. So it doesn't take long to get in the ice when you start off basically at the Arctic Circle. Now, we left out of Godhaven and came over, sailed north to northeast Disko Bay, and then into a series of fjords. We're really like in a series of fjords that's within a series of fjords, if that makes any sense. And that's where this island is, this uninhabited island that I'm sitting on currently. We came over here to deploy the pressure sensors for Dr. Miller and RBR. This is an interesting scientific project because we're sort of testing to see if this can be done. It hasn't really been verified. So basically, you have these pressure sensors, and these sensors detect these minute changes of pressure in the water. So every time a glacier calves off an iceberg, glaciers create icebergs. All the icebergs come from glaciers. And glaciers are like a slow-moving river. They're kind of like taffy, you know, very slow-moving, and anyways, they get to the water and they break off big chunks. The idea is that when they break off a big chunk, they break off an iceberg, it will create a wave, and these pressure sensors will detect the wave. So really, we're doing two things. First off, we are proving that these sensors can detect waves and creating a method, a scientific method, for deploying these sensors properly so they can be used by other scientists in the future. And second off, assuming that they are going to work, and I believe they will, there has been some testing in the past, nothing at this scale. I mean, the magnitude that we're doing is 10 times the magnitude of what's been done previously. But I believe that they will successfully detect. They have in the past on a smaller scale. So the next thing is, once you get this data, you could actually find out how many times the glacier has calved off an iceberg over that period of time. So if you leave this sensor in the water for a month, let's say, it should be able to count how many times that glacier has calved off icebergs. Now, this is important because this will tell you the rate of the flow of the glacier itself. And, you know, the faster the glacier is moving, potentially the more water is coming off of the Greenland ice cap. These glaciers are ultimately connected to this giant chunk of ice that is the Greenland ice cap. Most of Greenland is covered in ice. Greenland is not very green, typically speaking. It was a trick from the Vikings. It was, I believe it was Eric the Red. I don't remember if it was Eric the Red or Leif Erikson. It was either father or son. One of them came over here. They found Iceland, and they found Greenland, and they wanted to trick everybody. They didn't want people going to Iceland because they liked Iceland more. So they called Greenland green and Iceland ice, when really it should have been the other way around. Now, I'm not saying that Iceland is necessarily the greenest place you ever seen either. But Greenland is mostly ice. It's just the sort of fringes of the continent, of this massive island. I guess it's not really a continent. Technically, Greenland is part of North America, although it's kind of a sketchy classification, to be honest with you. But anyways, only the fringes of the island are inhabited. So you got this massive island. If you were to overlay it in the United States or in North America, the southern tip of Greenland would be in Mexico City. And the northern end of Greenland would be in Montana. So, I mean, it's just north to south, it is a huge island. East to west, it's still, you know, hundreds of miles across. So it's a pretty big place, but there's only 56,000 people living here. Part of that is because it's a harsh place to live, and, you know, people have been kind of holding on to surviving by their fingernails for thousands and thousands of years. But anyways, back to the research. This research, the primary investigator is Dr. Clark Richards. Dr. Clark Richards works for RBR, this sensor company, and he's working directly with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. Clark got his postdoctorate at Woods Hole, so that's why he's working with them. And we are the third party in this equation that is actually deploying the sensors, and then we got to come back near the end of the expedition, and we got to pick the sensors back up again. But they will be in the water for at least 6 weeks, maybe a little longer, 7 weeks. I'm not sure how long it's going to take before we get back here again. I'm not sure how many of these sensors we're going to find again, to be honest. But I'll get into that in a second. So we came in, we crossed Disco, we had a bit of wind. Yeah, nice little sail. There's a high pressure system that sits over western Greenland in the summertime, so you get a lot of light winds. Now, that said, there was a strong El Nino, turned El Nina, that really screwed up a lot of the different wind patterns. I'm really curious on how that system, which is far away, you know, on the planet, but how that system may or may not affect this high pressure that sits over Greenland. My hopes is that either it strengthens the high pressure or doesn't do anything at all. We really need calm weather when we're working in these fjords, when we're surrounded by ice. You know, if I could send Poseidon an email and get a weather request, I would want to have wind, preferably behind us, every time we went from one research site to the next research site. Again, some of these research sites are hundreds of miles apart. But when you actually get to the location that you need to do the research or deploy sensors or whatever you're doing, you really want it to be flat calm. You know, ideally you want it to be like a swimming pool with zero knots of wind. Of course, the problem with zero knots of wind is that there's a lot of mosquitoes. It doesn't take a lot of wind to get the mosquitoes to go away. And actually, right now, there are no mosquitoes around me. But like I said, it's midnight, and it seems like the mosquitoes, I don't know, go to bed or whatever. They're not out at night. And again, I mean, night is not really night, as there's sun, you know, the sun never sets. I can see perfectly clear in all directions as if it was maybe 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening as opposed to midnight. And it won't get any darker than this. The further north we get, the more light it is. And when we get to our furthest north, the sun just goes around and around and around in the sky. And 2 o'clock in the afternoon looks exactly like 2 o'clock in the morning. You have to use a 24-hour clock, because using a 12-hour clock, you look at it, it says 2 o'clock. But if you don't see an AM or PM, then you have no idea if it's 2 in the morning or 2 in the afternoon. So we came into this fjord, and I knew there was going to be a lot of ice. And we started working our way up into it, and, you know, ice increases and ice increases. And it's actually a good practice run for us, because when we get up to Kanak and we do our primary research for NASA, it's going to be just absolutely chock full of ice. So it's good for us to get a bit of practice. It's also good for us, our crew. You know, our crew has never sailed in the ice before, so it's good for them to get some experience. I say there's no mosquitoes, and I just watched one buzz right past my head. But anyways, it's good for them to get some experience before we get up into this, like, super icy area. And not that this isn't. I mean, we just got kicked out of our anchorage by 3 giant icebergs. So we get up, we start going up this fjord, and the ice builds. And it's not as much big ice. You know, big ice, I mean, like, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of foot tall, massive giant icebergs. And more like ice the size of, well, maybe a garage, or maybe a house, or a school bus. And then all sorts of other pieces. It's everything from the size of a baseball to the size of a refrigerator, semi-truck. And it's just strewn about everywhere. And the further we push our way up this fjord, the heavier and denser the ice becomes. You know, the more of it in the water. So about 6 miles south of this island, we sort of hit a wall of ice. It wasn't impenetrable, but it forced us to slow our boat down to about 2 knots of overall speed. And, you know, you put somebody on the bow of the boat with a whisker pole, and they sort of point left and right. They have a VHF. They have a handheld VHF. We have a VHF. So they'll say port starboard, 5 degrees port, 3 degrees starboard. And then you just sort of do what they say, basically, in a very slow fashion. Now, while we're slowly working our way through this ice, we looked over, and I saw a boat approaching on the AIS. And this was a local boat, maybe about a 25-foot vessel, power boat. And I kid you not, this boat was going 26 knots. According to the AIS, it was going 26 knots. I mean, we're going like 2 knots, and we're dodging ice left and right, slowly weaving in and out of the pack. I mean, I have never seen a boat quite like this. I mean, it was zigging and zagging at 26 knots, and when it zigged, it was like so hard, the boat would heel over, you know, like incredibly far, and then it would zag back and heel over the other direction. And it was, I mean, it's like these guys got a death wish. I mean, it's hard to imagine. I mean, all I can make of the situation, these are obviously Greenlandic people driving this thing. They grew up around this ice, and they're like ice ninjas. You know, they're ice ninjas. I don't know what else to make of it. You know, if I tried to do that, I would be dead in like the first 20 minutes. And somehow, these guys just, I saw it last year too, up north, on even smaller boats, like 16-foot open dinghies, you know, things that look like a Walker Bay, basically, with like a 50-horse outboard on the back. And they're flying at like 16, 18, 20 knots and incredibly heavy ice. Those are fiberglass boats. I mean, it's like, what are you going to do if you hit one of these things that's like a refrigerator? And you just got a propeller back there? I mean, well, don't you trash the outboard? I'm blown away by it. I have absolutely no idea how these guys... I hear that a lot of people die from it, to be honest. I mean, that's what I hear. There's a lot of accidents and a lot of people die. And it's funny, when I was in a boatyard in Sisimiut, the other boats around us were fishing boats. And this guy who was working on his fishing boat told us that in Greenland, the fishermen, they don't bring immersion suits and they don't bring survival equipment, because why prolong your death? And, you know, you got to kind of like that attitude. I mean, obviously, that attitude is completely fatalistic, and we have immersion suits and life rafts and every piece of safety equipment that I could possibly afford and get my hands on. But, you know, their mentality is like, it's like the mentality of the old tall ship sailors. You know, back in the days of the tall ships, most of those sailors didn't know how to swim. And their idea was, why should I learn how to swim? If I fall into water, it's just going to prolong my death. And these Greenlandic fishermen are the same way. They're like, you know, why prolong our death? We're just going to go down with the ship and that's it. So they definitely have a bit of a different attitude than we do. And I am not going through this ice any faster than basically idle, because it's just crazy. But anyways, we navigate through the ice and we get up to this island. We're calling the island Arrowhead Island because it kind of looks like an arrowhead on the map. And we get up to this island, and now it's time to find an anchorage.
Hi, I'm Dave Dempsey from Marine Intelligence. If you're the owner or captain of a superyacht, then you know how expensive internet can be. And yes, it's a ripoff. We've made it our mission to revolutionize the world of marine communications. We will find you the best price for your internet by comparing all major vendors. And we do that for free. That's right, no charge to the boat. It's a free service. We get you the best price for your yacht, whether it's just one boat or a fleet of boats. And all the savings will be passed on to you. We can save you over $1,000 per meg. So stop doing what you're doing and visit marineintelligence.net now, before you forget.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly, founder of Skipper's Review. I started Skipper's Review because I wanted somewhere online for my local boating community to make connections and recommendations. So now it's up and running. I've been getting out of the office to enjoy the Florida sunshine and to meet some of my members. Each week, you can hear me swapping salty tales with sailors, surfers, swimmers, divers, boat owners, and builders, anyone with a story to tell about their life and their relationship with the sea. So join me, Sarah O'Kelly, with Skipper's Review on Boat Radio.
Welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, sitting on an uninhabited island in West Greenland, right outside of Disco Bay, northeast Disco Bay. I'm sitting here watching the ice go by, swatting mosquitoes. mosquitoes have found me. They're not nearly as bad as they are in the daytime. I mean, they come by clouds, like thousands of them. I really don't understand this. Last year, we saw two mosquitoes. I mean, that's it. Two mosquitoes in Nuuk. And we were all over Greenland, all over West Greenland. Never saw a mosquito in the day or the night. And so I came up with this general assumption that, you know, mosquitoes, they must be inland. You know, I mean, I hear about mosquitoes. I hear the mosquitoes are so thick, you know, they can carry you away. But we have seen thousands and thousands of mosquitoes already, and this is basically still the beginning of the expedition. So all I can make of it is every year is different up here. You know, well, some years you can come up here and literally have no mosquitoes at all, and other years you can be absolutely swarmed by them. And I really don't know what makes that different. It is a little bit warmer this year, I will say. It's last year was a bit colder. So I don't know. Who knows? But that's another good thing about having a pilot house, by the way. In another episode, I was talking about how it's nice to be out of the elements, the cold, the wind, the rain. But you know what? The pilot house also keeps us out of the mosquitoes. You know, when we're motoring around or we're hanging out on anchor, I can stand in my pilot house and see 1,000 mosquitoes buzzing all around the boat. But very few of them actually make it into the pilot house, although a surprising number do. I mean, we've probably killed 50 mosquitoes in the last 24 hours sitting on anchor. So anyways, we approached this island that I'm calling Arrowhead Island. And this island was of particular significance to the scientists, to Dr. Clark Richard at RBR, and also to Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, because there are several high-speed, high-rate glaciers in the area that calve off a lot. That's why we got so much ice around us, is because these glaciers are constantly calving off icebergs. And then the icebergs break apart, and you know, one iceberg creates 1,000 little icebergs over time as it breaks into pieces. So what they wanted us to do is deploy these sensors on the eastern side of this island. We tried to get around to the eastern side of this island when we first came into the area. You know, we saw this area, and the ice was just getting thicker and heavier. And we ended up stopping the boat and doing a little bit of reconnaissance with the drone. We have a Phantom 4 drone. Linker Tech sponsored us with this drone. It was very nice of them. It's really coming in handy. I mean, it's nice for the cinematography. It's nice for the video blogs that we're posting on our website at www.oceanresearchproject.org. But it's really for safety, so we can see the ice. You can fly about 3 miles with one of these drones. So anyways, we stopped the boat, we put the drone up in the air, put the bird in the air, and went over, and we saw that it was just way too much ice. I mean, it was, you know, pancaked ice along the east coast of this. And the east coast of this little island is directly across from these three major glaciers. They're dumping off all this ice. So what are we going to do, you know? Everything is uncharted in this section. I mean, you don't have soundings, really. You don't... there is some charting. I shouldn't say everything is uncharted. South of Upernavik, you still do get some soundings, and there are a few, but there's really not many. You know, there's still rocks all over the place that are uncharted. There's actually islands on the chart that don't exist in real life. Coming up here, just within a few miles of here, we saw two islands that were on two different electronic charts. One was Navionics, and the other was Danish charts. And this island was there two different times, two different locations, these islands, that just literally did not exist. So you can't trust the charts, to say the very least. We came around and we tucked in the on the west side of this island. We found a nice little bay, and we came in and we dropped anchor. Deep in this bay, we found a spot that was shallow enough. One of the big problems anchoring in Greenland is just finding a place that's shallow. We can drop anchor pretty easily in 50 feet or 60 feet of water, you know, in 20 meters of water, and we did it a lot last year, but I would rather not. And it isn't because you need to put out a lot of scope, or it isn't because, you know, the anchor has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the fact that if you're in 50 feet of water, that means that an iceberg that is 49 feet deep can come up and come, you know, wipe you off your anchor. It can come up and plow you down as it chugs along with the current. And the current comes in and out. You know, there's quite a bit of tide difference. You can have 10 feet, 12 feet, 15 feet of tide difference, depending on where you are. And so the tide can really get moving, and these massive icebergs, I mean, one that has, you know, let's say 49 feet of draft, it might only be sticking up 5, 6, 8 feet out of the water, and maybe it's the length of a semi-truck, but it weighs just, you know, tons and tons and tons and tons. I mean, it's much heavier than our boat, and so you want to get into shallow water, not just for the sake of your, you know, of scope and letting out less anchor chain or any of that stuff. It's just because, you know, the shallower you get, the smaller the berg that's going to come along. It's inevitable in this kind of area that icebergs are going to come along and bounce off your boat. I mean, ice is everywhere. I'm looking ahead right now, sitting on the side of this little uninhabited island, and I don't know, I must see several thousand pieces of ice. I mean, at least maybe 2,000, 3,000. I mean, it's just ice everywhere. Now, most of this ice would be smaller ice, you know, the stuff that's the size of a refrigerator or smaller, or maybe the size of a SUV or smaller. You know, I probably see 30 or 40 of them at least that are massive, you know, hundreds of tons of ice. You'll know when they come bouncing off your boat. You'll hear a loud thud, you know, bam, right on the side of your boat. And, okay, time to go out there with the whisker pole and push it away. And, you know, for the most part, part, you push away the ice, it's not too big of a deal. You know, sometimes the ice is so big that when you try to push away the berg, really what you're doing is you're pushing your boat away from the berg. The berg isn't moving, it's your boat that's moving. So we came in here, we dropped an anchor. So plan B, we needed a plan B. We couldn't deploy these sensors using our boat like we were hoping we were going to do. So we decided to hike it out, do it on foot. Greenland is very rocky. This particular island has a 1,500 foot or 500 meter ridge line going right through the middle of it. And the terrain itself, because we're still a bit southern, in northern Greenland is just rock. You will find some patches of this like mossy, peaty stuff, but it's mostly just rock. But down here, I mean, we're not in southern Greenland. We're sort of in central West Greenland right now in this northeast Disco Bay fjord area. But this island has a whole lot of this green, mossy stuff. Walking on this stuff is like walking on a trampoline. I mean, your foot sinks down at least 6 inches with every single step. So it makes for a difficult place to go for a hike. And it's also pretty moist. You know, it's kind of like a bog. So you know, your shoes get soaked. If you don't have good waterproofing on your shoes, then your socks get soaked. Now you got to walk around for miles with wet feet. All of us couldn't go on this trip. You know, again, we launched the drone. We tried to use the drone to figure out the best route up this ridge line and to get over to the north side. This anchorage we're in, this bay is on really the southwest side. And it's the northeast side, the other side of the island, where we wanted to deploy most of these sensors, because that's where sort of it will have the most activity to be able to hear this calving activity. Yeah, and this island is about 5 miles across. So somebody had to stay with the boat, and that was me. In this anchorage, as I explained, there's ice all over the anchorage and coming and going with the current, and somebody has to stay with the boat, because if one of these big chunks of ice come in, it can trip your anchor and it will push you right up onto a rocky shoreline, and you will be shipwrecked on a rocky shoreline on an uninhabited island, you know, in the Arctic. I mean, it's not a situation you want to be in. So I stayed back, and Nicole and Dana and Alexander went off to deploy these sensors. And it was a pretty massive ordeal. It ended up being a 15-mile hike. They had about 5,000 feet of elevation change, because they had to go up ridges, down ridges, up ridges, down ridges. It took them 12 hours. And all this time, they were either going up this kind of slick rock or trudging through these like bogs of this heat that's like a trampoline, where you're always sinking down with every single step. Each and every one of them had a heavy backpack on, because in order to deploy these sensors, you have to bring weights. So the weights we brought were actually parts of a Perkins engine. There was a Perkins engine that was in a million pieces at the boatyard in Sisimiut, and they were throwing it away. And so we grabbed a bunch of gears, and, you know, mostly gears from the engine, you know, like maybe 6-inch, 8-inch gears that weighed, I don't know, 5 pounds or so. So everybody had a heavy backpack on. They also had a rifle. The chance of seeing a polar bear around here is pretty slim. And, you know, the second to last thing that I want to do is shoot a polar bear. But the last thing I want is to have a polar bear eat my crew alive. And unlike big cats, if a tiger or a lion attacks you, typically they'll kill you before they eat you. A bear will just hold you down and eat you. And they're 1,000 pounds, and they run 35 mile an hour right at you. And, you know, it's just not a situation you want to be in. So we bring a rifle. It's absolutely pointless to have a rifle and to use a rifle if you haven't been trained properly. And I've been around guns for, you know, for quite some time, and I've owned quite a bit of them in the States. So I trained everybody how to use it, and everybody hit the target on the first shot. Although I did add new sights, ghost sights, for those who gun aficionados out there. I added ghost sights, which are really nice sights. It makes it much easier to hit a target. Anyways, they go trampling off. I had a lot of work to do on the boat anyways, and so I was messing with the scientific equipment, the CO2 sensor, and, you know, it's just the boat work never ends, you know. I had to mess with the plumbing again, and And so I had a full day of just fixing things around the boat while they were off hiking. And be honest with you, I like to have my alone time. I mean, I spent 309 days alone going around the Americas. And I'm not a total hermit, but, you know, at the same time, I do like having some time alone. And they came back 12 hours later, and I cooked a nice chicken curry. We had a bit of some red curry, coconut curry, and had the meal waiting for them. I had a fire in the fireplace. We have a wood-burning stove on our boat in the forward cabin, so I had a nice fire roaring in the wood-burning stove, and I broke out the whiskey. We had some good Irish whiskey, and I took some ice, you know, little chunks of iceberg out of the water and broke them up and put them in everybody's glass. And so when they came back, and they were completely wiped out. And be honest with you, I was jealous. You know, I mean, that feeling of accomplishment you get after a big sort of epic hike. You know, I mean, it's a pain in the ass when you're doing it. They were completely surrounded by mosquitoes the entire time. And they were like breathing in mosquitoes, you know, as they were hiking. Nicole has like 300 mosquito bites because she wore like tight pants, you know, like yoga pants, and they were able to bite right through her yoga pants. So her legs and her butt are just covered in mosquito bites. But anyways, and they were completely, you know, their feet covered in blisters, but there's that sense of accomplishment, you know, when you're completely wiped out at the end of a big journey like that. So yeah, I was a little bit jealous of that. But you know, like I said, somebody had to stay back with the boat. And it might as well be me, because I can pull the anchor and move the boat by myself if necessary without much of an issue. So we get back and we have a day of recovery the next day, and you know, we're sitting in this which initially this bay was pretty ice free at the very, we tucked in all the way to the very end of this bay. And initially it was ice free, but the ice changes day to day. It changes like the weather. And just about 2 hours ago, three massive bergs, massive enough, came in, and I try to get in the dinghy, and I try to push them away with the dinghy, which is a completely futile scenario. We don't have an outboard engine. We just row, row, row the boat. I've been rowing boats for years anyways. I typically don't use outboards, but I couldn't move the damn things. So we just ended up pulling anchor and moving to a different part of the bay where there was less ice. There's still ice everywhere, but at least they're not the big, giant chunks of ice anymore. And who knows, when the tide changes, the ice will get sucked back out of this, and we might have some big berg trying to run us over. And so maybe in the middle of the night, we'll have to pull anchor again and move again. Who knows? You know, I mean, that's sort of the way it is around here. It's just, you're always playing the ice. And it does. It changes with every single tide. So when a high tide comes, if you're in one of these bays, a high tide will bring the ice in. A low tide will push it back out. Also, the wind drives it. So the wind will also push the ice in, or the wind will blow the ice out. And for the last 36 hours, the wind has been blowing right into the bay, blowing the ice in with it. So that's part of the reason, and it got so icy, you know. But anyways, we're going to leave out of here tomorrow. We have to deploy another 5 sensors in a very icy area just north of here. It's going to be super icy. We're going to be navigating through it very slowly, pushing bergs away. And then we're going to try to escape through a short but incredibly icy corridor back out into Baffin. And I don't know how we're going to do it, but, you know, and then we're going to go up to Upernavik. So when we come back, I'll be in Upernavik, and I'll let you know how it went.
Smartest long-tail catch you'll find it. Ho way, ho way, you must hunt. She's the lady say of the salty times. Clear away the track and let the bull jine run to me. Hey, rig a jig, she's a jaunting free.
We're living our dream.
We're living simply and sustainably aboard a sailboat traveling the world.
We're visiting remote communities and raising awareness about the health of our oceans.
Patrolling the oceans for microplastic particles.
We're checking on the health of coral reefs and phytoplankton populations.
We're monitoring marine mammals and examining synthetic materials in fish.
We're Bass and Jamie Van Jones.
And we're proof that citizen science can save the world.
Hear all about our amazing adventures in salty times every week here on Boat Radio.
Stay salty.
You.
And the board of the ladies say, clear away the tack and let the boat join run.
I'm Michael John, and each month on Boat Radio, I'll be looking at life on London's magnificent River Thames, from the dredgers emptying their cargoes of sand and gravel, to the mudlarks combing the shore for lost treasures. I'll be meeting the people, visiting the places, and boarding the ships that work this mighty, muddy artery. So join me, Michael John, for Tales of the Thames on Boat Radio.
Hello and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford. Well, I'm currently in Upernavik. Upernavik is the last town in northern Greenland before you really start getting remote. Sort of the last place you can get anything, I guess. Well, you can get groceries and fuel other places, but and there ain't really much here. I mean, there's no restaurants, there's no cafes, there's no Wi-Fi. There is one bar that opens, I don't know, a couple days a week, and it's cold. It's like 4 in the morning. My boat is tied off to a seawall. It's about 10 feet below me. It's a gnarly seawall. I mean, it's just, it's not the kind of wall you really want to be tied off to, but the conditions are pretty minimal right now. There's a huge amount of ice in the harbor. We were here a couple times last year. I never seen this much ice in the harbor before. It's rather incredible, really. And that's because the wind blew it in. There was a strong northeasterly wind, and it blew all the ice in. But I'm trying to pace around here. I'm actually kind of freezing my butt off right now. The fog has rolled in, and the fog is really cold. You know, it's got a moisture to it, so it's wet, and it just cuts right down into your bones, you know. It's just... But it's sleepy town right now. Upernavik is a pretty place. Every once in a while, all the dogs start barking. From Upernavik north, you have more of the sort of traditional Inuit culture. Dog sledding is a really big thing in the winter. And in some ways, it's, you know, it's sort of a shame. Greenland really comes alive in the winter. In the summertime, the towns, especially the smaller towns, are isolated. There are no roads in Greenland that connect the towns. So in the winter, everything freezes, and they get out their dog sleds, and basically the water becomes a highway, and then they're able to go from one town to the next. But when the ice melts, they're stuck in their little towns until the ice comes back again. So anyways, we deployed a bunch of pressure sensors. When I talked to you last, I was on an uninhabited island. I was calling it Arrowhead Island, and we thought we were going to go north to deploy these sensors. We tried to go north, and we ended up getting blocked by the ice trying to get to this fjord. And not just blocked by the ice, I mean, it wasn't that simple. You know, there's very strong currents. Ice is such a funny thing, especially in these sort of areas where you have sort of fjords inside of fjords with islands within the fjords, and there's so many different things that deflect current. And so you have one iceberg going one direction, you have a whole bunch of other icebergs going another direction. There's almost no rhyme or reason to it. They're just sort of zigzagging all over the place. And you can literally, I mean, I've seen it before, you can have like maybe 10 pieces of ice flowing one way, and you can have one piece of ice flowing the opposite direction pretty much amongst the 10. It's like, how in the world are you doing this? It's like they got a mind of their own. So we were creeping in, and we were looking, and the path looked pretty blocked, but and the current was pretty bad, and so we got to a point where we had to stop and turn back. And not long after that, trying to work our way back south again in this fjord area with ice everywhere, we sort of paused. We were waiting because there was a large iceberg with a whole bunch of small icebergs all sort of moving along. And they're moving really fast, maybe 3 knots or 4 knots. You know, I mean, the icebergs are pretty much screaming along. And we were trying to find a moment between these icebergs that we could, like, hit the gas, you know, throw the throttle up and blaze, you know, through it. With, I don't know if you're familiar with the game Frogger. Frogger is an old video game from the 1980s, but I was, you know, we were feeling like Frogger at that moment. And what I didn't see, and nobody else saw, is coming up behind us was a giant iceberg, like massive thing, you know, 100, well, it wasn't as big as some of them can be, but it was a good 100 feet tall. I mean, it was way bigger than we were, and this thing was screaming up on us at 4 knots. So I turn around, look over my shoulder, and there's an iceberg like a boat length away, a big old iceberg coming at us at 4 knots. So we had to just, you know, gun it and and squeeze through this ice, and it was, of course, going the opposite direction of all the other ice. You know, it was, and this is all in very close proximity. I mean, this is not, you know, we're not talking, you know, a quarter mile apart or anything like that. I mean, we're talking within a few boat lengths. You got ice going one way and ice going another way. So this thing tried to run us over, and we got out of there. So we ended up heading south. And we wanted to get these sensors deployed as close to the glacier as possible. We deployed the five sensors, and when I say we, really Nicole, Alexander, and Dana, they did that 15-mile hike because there was so much ice. They had it deployed on foot. They couldn't. We couldn't bring the boat around to that side of Arrowhead Island. This was another fjord to the south. We wanted to get, the idea is to deploy these sensors no further than twice the width of the glacier. So let's say the glacier is a half mile wide. You do not want to deploy these sensors more than a mile away. So we really wanted to outdo ourselves. So we got real close to this glacier. I mean, it wasn't dangerously close. There was some calving activity. This particular glacier wasn't calving off huge bergs, although it was probably a good half mile wide glacier, but it was a ton of ice. So we spent 18 hours navigating heavy ice just to deploy these five sensors, you know, one on either side of the glacier, two back from those, and then one on a little island sort of in the center. And the funny thing is, this little island wasn't even on our charts. I mean, it was not just uninhabited, but uncharted. And, you know, we're looking at this thing, we're like, what is this island doing here? But that happens. I mean, often, usually it's the opposite. Usually the chart shows an island that doesn't exist in reality. Normally it isn't the other way around. This time there was an island that existed in reality that wasn't on the charts. But anyways, we put a sensor there, so it does exist. Real heavy ice though. I mean, heavy ice to the point, I mean, you know, you navigate through the ice and, you know, thousands of pieces and whatever. You zigzag your boat, and we have somebody on the front of the boat with a whisker pole sort of pushing away the bigger chunks, and we're moving along pretty slowly. But this is really heavy brash ice. As you get close to the glacier itself, this ice is, there is no water, you know, it's just all ice. It's an absolute jumble of brash ice, and, you know, there isn't one square foot of clean water amongst the ice. And so you push your boat in at about a one knot, you know, you approach it at about a half a knot, sort of bump your nose, your boat up into the ice, and then you basically work the throttle, neutral, trying to keep the boat between 0.7 knot and 1.2 knots, because you're hitting big ice all the time. I mean, big ice as in the size of refrigerators and washing machines, mixed with a lot of ice the size of baseballs and soccer balls and things of that nature. So you're pushing your way through this stuff. But, you know, as long as you go slow, the boat carves its way through. So we got up to this one deployment place right up by the glacier. One sketchy thing, though, is that because the calving activity of the glacier, it produces waves. So there's, or produces swell, I should say. So there's swell going up and down in these landing spots, and these landing spots are not beaches. So, you know, we have a dinghy, put the dinghy in the water. It's a hard dinghy. It's a porta boat. It's an all right thing. So we put it in the water, and Dana and Nicole got in and started rowing. And they were rowing. There wasn't water to put it in. Like, we put it on the ice, basically, and they were rowing through ice. It makes for really funny footage, and we got a video of it. We should have another video on the website. Well, by the time this airs, the video should be on the website, because I'm a couple few weeks ahead of the radio show. But yeah, I could check out the video. It's one thing for me to explain it. It's a whole other thing to see it. But, you know, the problem is, so they get up near the land to deploy this thing, the sensor, and there's a swell going up and down, and it's like a rock, like a cliffy rock thing. And it's pretty sketchy. But anyways, you know, all in the name of science, we got to get these things out. We got to see if these things work. And this is a perfect location to do it, nice and close, within, you know, less than the width of the glacier. You know, we got about a quarter mile or so from the glacier itself, maybe less than that even. And as I say, it was a fairly calm glacier. Some glaciers are calving all the time, and they calve huge icebergs. You got to be really careful about those glaciers, because they calve off a monster, and that can make a real big wave. I could tell that this glacier was more benign by looking at the ice that it was producing, the icebergs it was producing. And typically speaking, there were no icebergs bigger than a house. And I, you know, that includes the 2/3 of the iceberg you can't see. Well, actually, maybe bigger than two or three houses combined. You know, you can see the chunk that you see, it looks like a house or the size of a house. And then, of course, two-thirds of the iceberg is underwater. So most of the iceberg you actually can't see. But those are the biggest ones they're making. And, you know, and when it comes to glaciers and icebergs, that's a pretty small iceberg. I mean, it sounds big, you know, three houses put together. But the real big glaciers, they make icebergs that are monsters. They're just, I don't know, 800 feet deep and, you know, 400 or 500 feet tall and just massive things. And we'll be dealing with that in Kanak later on in the expedition. And we're going to have to deal with those glaciers. We're going to be right up near those also. But anyways, we got those down and we went across and the fog came in, so it was really foggy. And we couldn't even see the glacier anymore, even though it was right by us. And you hear this cracking and rumbling from the glacier. You know, it sounds like a artillery sometimes, or like a really loud crack sort of noise. But it's hidden in the fog, and so you're just kind of like, oh, all right. And we get to the other side, and this side wasn't quite as icy. We had to push through some ice, but not nearly as bad as the north side. And they go over with the dinghy, and they put it on this rock thing, and they pull it up, and a big wave comes from some calving activity, a big swell, damn near washes the dinghy away. I watched this dinghy get lifted like 5 feet in the air and thrown about 20 feet off this rock, and they're like, you know, a couple hundred yards from the dinghy at this point because they're trying to deploy these sensors. So, yeah, I was like just sort of crossing my fingers, hoping and praying that we weren't going to lose this, lose our dinghy, or, you know, I don't know, we'd have to go after it. I mean, I was in a boat. I guess I had a decent chance of getting it, but nevertheless, it's not something that's fun to watch. But we got through that, and we got the other sensors deployed, and like I said, we did 18 hours, and it's sort of funny. You first start getting into the ice, you're going real slow, and you do adjust and get used to it. It's just like the fog. It's the same thing. You do get used to it. You don't go fast through the ice. You got to think about, you know, the impact and the weight and the load and all the rest if you do end up hitting one of these bergs. So you do try to keep it slower. But we were able to pick up the pace as everybody got sort of acclimatized to the ice and used to navigating through it and used to pushing off the bergs. So that worked out pretty well. We left out of Disco and continued on north. Did have a little bit of sailing. We haven't had much luck with the wind so far. The wind has mostly either been no wind or headwinds, you know, and that's sort of the classic story of sailing, you know. It's like, the wind's always against me. But it really has been. We had to pull off at one point coming up to Upernavik because, the wind was blowing about 20 knots on our nose, producing a swell that was slowing us down. But we had the most incredibly thick fog, and it was interesting. You know, normally fog is sort of a grayish, bluish color, but this fog, because of the lighting, it turned like a tan color, and so did the water. And so it made it very difficult to see where the water stopped and the fog started, you know. And it was like 50 feet visibility, you know, and there was ice everywhere, and we're using our radar the best we can to get through it, but I said, you know, we got to find a place to anchor. So we went, there is no anchorages, there isn't, you know, per se. I mean, there's no anchorage guides, there's no soundings in these places, so you go and try to find an anchorage. You try to find a place that's shallow enough to drop a hook right near some cliff face, you know. So, you know, we went up and we dropped the hook, and it was, you know, I don't know, 1,000-foot cliff or something right next to us. And we got up in the morning, and these had the most interesting little critters in the water around the boat. I was afraid there was millions of them. They were maybe the size of maybe a dime or something. They're pretty small, and they almost look like jellyfish. They're black, though. I'd never seen anything like them, and there were millions of them. I was afraid to start my engine because I might suck them in, you know, to my intake and end up filling up my strainer. You know, I said, "Oh, there's so many in the water. I'm gonna clog up my engine trying to just run the thing." But we did get out of there okay, and we had some wind. We were able to sail a bit. It seemed like my watch was always the watch where the wind died, and Nicole's watch was always the watch where the wind came back again, but out of the south. But we made it up here all right, and you know, here we are in Upernavik, tied off to this gnarly seawall. It's, like I said, it's about 4 in the morning. But things are moving fairly well. We got the our big sonar, the big guns, the CV-200, map out the seafloor down to 6,000 feet. We're going to need that for a project here starting in about a week or 10 days or so. So it's really good that that's together. We just found out today that $5,000 worth of funding we were supposed to get from one of our partners, we were supposed to get it today, and now they say, oh, we're not going to give it to you till mid-September, which is like, you got to be kidding me. Like, we're already broke and doing this on a shoestring. It's like, don't people realize we're in the Arctic? This isn't like the Chesapeake Bay, you know, and we need fuel and we need food, and you told us you'd have us this money, and I don't know, man. Start a nonprofit organization if you really want to have some frustration in your life. But anyways, we're going to be heading out to Baffin Bay to do some plastics research. So tune in next week to hear about, you know, we'll be hundreds of miles from land and all that good stuff. So anyways, go to oceanresearchproject.org to see more pictures, read the blogs, and see the videos, and make a donation. All right, thank you very much, and until next week.
Do you?